All right, welcome everyone. Welcome back to the Biblical Museum of Natural History. And happy Yom Yerushalayim, special day today. And today's topic is elephants and mammoths. That's what we're going to be dealing with today. And this is going to take us in three different halls of the museum. So let's begin with the obvious question. Where are elephants mentioned in Tanakh? And the answer is nowhere. Well, at least not exactly. What we do have in Tanakh is, in general, the animals of Tanakh are the animals of biblical lands, right? The animals of the area where Tanakh takes place. That's why there's no pandas or polar bears or penguins in Tanakh, because the children of Israel were not in that part of the world, right? However, there's a couple of exceptions. There are a couple of animals mentioned in Tanakh, which don't live in this part of the world, but they were imported. For example, domestic animals, right? Camels. Camels are not native to the land of Israel, but because they were domesticated, right? So they were imported, and that's how they come to feature in Tanakh. And then we also have reference to animals that were imported for other reasons, specifically to decorate King Solomon's palace. All right. So it says that the king had a fleet of ships that would come, bringing gold and silver and monkeys. There's a monkey up behind me. And peacocks. There we go. There's a peacock up there. And, you know, to decorate the king's palace. And the other thing they would bring is shenhabim. What is shenhabim? It is elephant ivory. Right? So behind me, we have the, the thing is, they're so big, I'm going to have to move the camera further away so you can see them. Hang on a second. There we go. I'm just going to run and stand next to them so you can see how big they are. All right. All right, these are our enormous elephant tusks, which I brought here myself from Africa on the plane. Let me tell you, that was quite a scene at the airport. I arrived at Johannesburg Airport 4 hours ahead of my flight. Thought I'd better give this a chance, show them to El Al. I was saying, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. Eventually they did let me bring these tusks to Israel. Of course, there are prohibitions on elephant ivory, but these are actually replicas. They are perfect replicas of the original. The original set stayed in Africa, and I was able to bring these replicas back. Going through customs, of course, I was pulled, and I had to convince them that, no, these are not actual ivory. These are replicas. And then they were worried that maybe I'd stuffed them with drugs. So they did have to feed them through the x-ray machine to make sure they weren't stuffed with drugs. But these are drug-free, perfect replicas of elephant tusks. Now, these are pretty big. As you can see, they're about 7 or 8 feet long. Elephant tusks can be even longer than this. They can be 11 feet long. They can weigh 200 pounds, you know, per tusk. And a lot of people say, but you don't see elephants with tusks like that nowadays. And it's true. You don't often see elephants with tusks like this. And the reason is that elephants with big tusks were hunted, right? They were the ones that were hunted for the ivory, and they were removed from the gene pool. So the only elephants left in the gene pool were those elephants which weren't growing such big tusks. So that's how there's been artificial selection, and that's why it's very rare nowadays to see elephants with tusks the size of this. But they are mentioned in Tanakh. They were imported. And what were they used for? So it says that King Shlomo, King Solomon, it says, Vayas HaMelech Kisei Shen Gadol, which literally translates to the king made a great chair of teeth, or he made a chair of great teeth, depending on whether the word gadol, great, is going on the chair or the teeth. But either way, the only kind of teeth you'd use to make a chair are elephant teeth. All right, so King Solomon made his throne out of ivory. And that is the only reference to elephants in Tanakh, right, in terms of their tusks, which were imported for King Solomon along with monkeys and peacocks. However, although that's the only reference to elephants in Tanakh, when it comes to the Gemara, we have some very, very interesting additional references. And before we discuss those, we're going to move into a different room. We are going to move into our Hall of Wonders. Let me just roll the camera to our Hall of Wonders. And Here we go. So in our Hall of Wonders, we have many extraordinary creatures from the natural world. We also have our exhibits of models of Noah's Ark. But as we always tell people in here, it's difficult to ignore the elephant in the room, which is literally the elephant in the room. Hang on a second. I'm just going to turn on the air conditioning in here because it's sweltering today. Hopefully I can do it from my phone. All right, so behind me is an elephant.
Quite big.
There we go. You can see how big it is. What a lot of visitors ask is this a real elephant? Sorry, is this, you know, it's a model. It's not a stuffed elephant. The reason why it's not a stuffed elephant is that stuffed elephants are kind of difficult to come by. And in general, what we find is that if it's an animal that doesn't have fur, it's better to have a model. It's much better to have a model than to try and get a taxidermy. So it's a model elephant. What a lot of people wonder is, you know, is this, people come to it and they say, isn't this much bigger than a real elephant? And the answer is no, it's not bigger. And in fact, it's not even as big as elephants get. This elephant here, it's 3 meters. It's about 10 feet tall. Maximum height for an elephant is 14 feet tall. Right, nearly a third as tall again. So elephants really can be absolutely gigantic. Now, as we know, there's two types of elephants, right? There's African elephants and there's Indian elephants. And the way you tell them apart is very straightforward. Right? If you're in Africa and you see an elephant, that's an African elephant. And if you're in India and you see an elephant, that would be an Indian elephant. What would you do if you're in Bet Shemesh or somewhere else? Well, there's a few ways to tell them apart. African elephants are overall much, much bigger, right? The ones that get to 14 feet tall are African elephants. African elephants have ears that are kind of, that are much, proportionately much bigger and kind of shaped like Africa. This model, the ears are not so precise, but African elephants have proportionately much bigger ears. With African elephants, the males and the females both have tusks. The trunk, right? At the end of the trunk, there's these little fingers. Right, they're actually mobile. So with an Indian elephant, it's just one finger at the end of the trunk. And with an African elephant, it's two fingers at the end of the trunk. All right. Now, what were the elephants that were imported? The ivory was imported for King Solomon's palace, probably Indian elephants. If they were coming along with monkeys and peacocks, it means they were coming from India. That would have been Indian elephants. Now, as I mentioned, the elephant is mentioned many times in the Gemara. And one of those is in regard to the bracha, the blessing that you recite upon an elephant. People are often very taken aback to hear that you make a bracha on an elephant. It's not talking about when you eat an elephant, right? You are not allowed to eat elephants. They are not kosher. But it's talking about when you see an elephant. Right? There are certain brachot, certain blessings you make when you see things. Right? There's a bracha that you make when you see beautiful creatures, which is Baruch Shekachalo Ba'olamo. Blessed is the one who has such things in his world. That's a bracha you make in exceptionally beautiful creatures. We have a beautiful parrot here that people make the bracha on. And in fact, one of the parrots that we have has gotten so used to hearing that bracha that he actually makes that bracha himself. I'm not joking. This is a parrot who makes the bracha, Baruch Shekachalo Ba'olamo. Blessed is the one who has such beautiful things in his world. But there's another bracha that you make on extraordinary creatures, and the Gemara specifically mentions an elephant. And that bracha is Baruch Mishana Habriot, which literally means blessed is the one who makes extraordinary creatures. All right, so why are elephants extraordinary? So we all know elephants are extraordinary, but exactly how? So first of all, of course, their size, right? Their tremendous size, as I mentioned, up to 14 feet tall. In fact, there was one particular, I say elephants on the whole don't get that big, but usually Africans top out at about 11 feet, but occasionally they get to 14 feet. In fact, there was a very famous elephant who got to that extreme height of 14 feet. Anyone know which elephant that was? A very famous elephant that was owned by London Zoo and then was sold to P.T. Barnum.
Jumbo.
Jumbo. Right. Jumbo, the elephant, right, was one of those particularly outsized African elephants. Their weight, right, elephants can weigh up to 22,000 pounds. Right, 22,000 pounds, absolutely gigantic weight. And there's their trunk. So, how many bones are there in an elephant's trunk? Anyone know? Zero. None at all. No bones in an elephant's trunk. How many muscles are there in an elephant's trunk? Any guesses?
Many.
200.
Many.
Or one, maybe.
200? You're actually between about 50 and 80,000. 50 and 80,000 muscles in an elephant's trunk. And they give it both tremendous strength. An elephant can knock your head off of its trunk. And also tremendous agility, dexterity. An elephant can pick up something very, very tiny with that trunk. And it's quite hard for elephants to learn how to use their trunk, right? A baby elephant will have the trunk kind of flopping around, and it will take him a while until he figures out how to move this great big thing sticking out of the edge of his head. All right, now, it's not the only amazing things about elephants. It's also how they communicate. Elephants communicate with infrasound, which is sound that is so low and so deep that it's beyond the range of human hearing. Right, you know how bats can hear sounds that are above the range of human hearing, or the elephants, it's the opposite, right? Sound that's below the range of human hearing. And the story behind that discovery is quite interesting. A lot of people have often said that when you approach a herd of elephants, you feel yourself shaking in fear. Right? You feel yourself trembling, physically trembling as you approach a large herd of elephants. And, these were often just dismissed as just exaggeration or whatever, some psychological thing. But then what happened was that there was a field scientist studying a group of elephants, and her car was vibrating, even though the engine was off at the time. So she brought in some sensitive audio equipment, and she found out what was happening is that the car was vibrating because of the infrasound that the elephants were emitting. And that can sometimes, it can resonate, your stomach can resonate at the same frequency. So these people who were trembling in fear as they approached the herd of elephants, right, it was actually their stomachs, their insides of their body was resonating at the same frequency as the sounds that the elephants were making. So that was the interesting explanation for that. All I can say also, just psychologically, it can be quite intimidating when you're on safari and you're next to a herd of elephants. They're just such gigantic creatures. Can be quite an intimidating animal. And the advantage of infrasound, by the way, is that it travels much further. Right, so by communicating with infrasound, elephants can send messages over vast distances. Whales also communicate with infrasound. And with the whales, they can send messages to other whales on the other side of the planet with infrasound. Right, it takes a couple of hours to get there, but it does get there. And marine biologists have even been able to decode what the whale is saying. It's saying, can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? No, just kidding. But they do travel vast distances. That is the advantage of infrasound. But it's that's another amazing aspect of elephants too. Hold on a second. Let me just slide this camera over. I'll show you something funny. We have a sign here. Mind the elephant in the room. All right, and that sign, it's not just a joke. We put that for a very serious reason. What happened is that, nowadays people walk around often with their phones, right, with their head in the phones. And what happened is people would walk here and on their phone, they wouldn't see the elephant trunk and they would knock themselves out on the tusks of the trunk. But at one point when somebody was actually literally knocked out on the floor, we realized we need to put a sign up, mind the elephant in the room. Just sliding the camera here, watch myself. All right, so what I want to show you is something up on the wall behind me. Zoom in here. Oh, it's glare exactly in it. Camera a bit. All right. So firstly, what is that? Anyone know what that is? Souvenir that I brought back from Africa. Anyone know what it is?
Footprint?
Yes, that is a footprint of an elephant. Right, a particular elephant called Jake, who I went riding on in Zimbabwe. This was with Toto in Motion. Right? We did these African trips where we went to all kinds of interesting places in Africa. We did a few of them. We hope to start them back up again next year. We used to go to South Africa, but that's been dropped from our destination list. So we're looking on planning a different trip next year, probably to East Africa. And that is the footprint of an elephant, correct? And there's another elephant aspect to the souvenir also. The paper that it's on is actually paper that is made from elephant poop. Dried elephant excrement, that's what the paper is made out of. But next to it, we have a very interesting picture. All right, there we have a painting of an elephant. Now, this painting is particularly significant because aside from being a painting of an elephant, the painting was also done by the elephant. Right, elephants hold paintbrushes in their trunks, and they're actually able to do paintings. Now, normally, when an elephant does a painting, it's just what they call in Israel, kushkushkaya. Right? It's just a scribble. But in certain parts of Thailand, the elephants will actually do a painting like this of an elephant. Now, the obvious question is, is it real? Is it trickery? So I've seen it on video. And as I saw the video of the elephant producing this picture that someone gave me, there is definitely some kind of trickery involved. In other words, there's an elephant trainer who is always touching the elephant, and he is somehow guiding the elephant on where to move the brush. I don't think the elephant itself conceives that it's painting an elephant, but still, even if it's being guided, it still represents an extraordinary, degree of skill. And just for comparison purposes, hold on. For comparison purposes, here is a painting that was done by an orangutan. Right, so the orangutan is really just abstract modern art, but the elephant was able to produce a painting of an elephant. I'll show you some other interesting things that I have here. So one time we were on safari and we got out, we saw all these like fragments of bone lying on the ground. And I was picking up one of them and I was saying, gosh, I'd love to take this back to my museum. The elephant bone is very interesting because elephants are so such big animals, right? So the bone needs to be actually honeycombed, right, inside, not solid, because otherwise it would just be too heavy. The bone would be too heavy for the elephant to move. So it's very interesting stuff. I wanted to take it back, but the guide we were with from the reserve in Africa said, no, you're not allowed to take anything out of the reserve, dead or alive, you can't take anything. So unfortunately, I had to put it back on the ground. And then at the end of the trip, I was actually flying back via New York. And at JFK Airport, one of the safari participants said to me, I've got something for you. And he opens up his suitcase and he takes out this great big chunk of elephant pelvis. He picked it up right after I put it down on the ground when no one was looking and stuffed it in his suitcase, much to his wife's horror. And truth is, I wasn't exactly sure what I was going to do. Now I was stuck in JFK Airport and I had this great big chunk of elephant pelvis that I had to somehow transport back to Israel with me. But anyway, that's the story how this came in. And as you can see, which is a good angle to hold it up at, you can see the honeycombing, like the birds, right? So birds' bones are honeycombed inside. They're not solid, they're honeycombed, and that's to reduce their weight when they fly. So elephants have to reduce the weight of their bones for a different reason, just because they can stand. So that's why the bone is honeycombed inside, right? It's all these cavities, right, inside the bone. And then we have another item of interest here. All right, what's this?
Tooth.
Right, this is the tooth of an elephant, right? The molar tooth of an elephant. All right, how many teeth do elephants have? You can tell me, how many teeth do elephants have? Type that into the chat box and unmute yourself. The answer is... Don't want to think a second. Six, right? Elephants have 16. They have two tusks, and then they have four molars, two in the top, two in the bottom. Right? But each molar, as you can see, is absolutely gigantic, right? Really, really huge. These are the roots, right? These are the roots of the tooth, and this is the grinding surface. And actually, often the a common cause for elephants' deaths is when their teeth wear out. Like eventually, right? What do elephants eat? Elephants eat vegetation. Oh, actually, let's start off with a different question. Why are elephants so big? What's the reason? Why are elephants so big? So, there's different ways of answering that question, but really I think the best way of answering that question is that elephants are so big because of the food they eat. Right? What do elephants eat? Elephants eat trees. Right? Not just leaves, but twigs, wood also. Right? The entire tree. And trees are not particularly nutritious. Not a lot of nutritional value in a tree. If you want to digest a tree, it's going to have to sit in the stomach, right, for days and days and days to be able to extract all that nutritional value from it. So elephants, because they eat trees, need to have very, very big stomachs. So because they have very big stomachs, therefore they have to be very big animals, right? And because they're eating trees, also they have to be able to chew the trees, right, and break them up. So they need very, very strong teeth, which means their skull is very, very heavy. So for that reason, the skull has to be, they can't have a skull and a long neck like a giraffe, right? The skull, because the skull is so big, the skull has to be close to the body. Then how do they get their food? So they need to have a trunk, right, that will be able to reach the food and put it in their mouth. You know, so every aspect of the elephant's anatomy, you know, can be explained all based on the most fundamental thing, which is that they eat trees. Right? In order to eat a tree, to have the space to digest it, to be able to chew them up, right, and everything. So that's how you end up with an elephant being the bizarre shape that an elephant is. It all comes down to what they eat. So these teeth are crucial in terms of grinding up the plant matter, grinding it up. So if the tooth wears out, then the elephant basically starves to death. Right? It can't digest the food. In captivity, it's fine. In captivity, it can be fed soft food. But in the wild, when an elephant's teeth wear out, that basically is the end of the life of the elephant. Well, they still can be very long-lived creatures. They can live, you know, 70, 80 years amongst the most long-lived creatures. Okay, so we've mentioned the bracha, right? Baruch Mashana HaBriot, which is the bracha you make in them for being so extraordinary in terms of their size, their trunks, their intelligence, right? Really, it's interesting. That bracha, Baruch Mashana HaBriot, the Gemara specifies two creatures that you make it on, an elephant and a monkey. And the question is it just giving those as examples of exotic animals? And really, you'd also make that bracha on a, you know, on a rhinoceros or anything else. Or does it mean specifically an elephant and a monkey? And if it's specifically an elephant and a monkey, why? So there are those who say it's just an example of an exotic animal. There are those who say, no, it's specifically elephants and monkeys. And one explanation of that is that what do elephants and monkeys have in common? You can tell me, what do elephants and monkeys have in common?
They are smart.
They're smart. Right, they are very, very, very smart. And being smart, like, that is normally the defining feature of a human. A defining aspect, sorry, of human beings, that we're very smart. So when you have animals that are very smart, then they're kind of human-like. Right, and in fact, there is discussion, if you look at my encyclopedia, Torah Encyclopedia of the Animal Kingdom, there is discussion about certain laws, halachot, Jewish laws, that may be different for elephants and monkeys than for other animals because of their tremendous intelligence. So there's one explanation that because elephants and monkeys are fundamentally like human beings, and yet they're still somewhat different, so that's the bracha, Mashana HaBriot, you know, contrasting elephants and monkeys, not with other animals, but contrasting them with humans. That even though they're fundamentally similar to us in terms of their great intelligence, nevertheless, they are still somewhat different, right? A radically different perspective on that bracha. Now, I'd like to turn to another elephant-related topic, and that has to do with some trouble that I got into many, many years ago. And, as you know, I have gotten into a spot of trouble in the past, right, with my some of my books were banned, were put in cherem. And that had to do with the stances that I took in certain Torah science topics, to do with the age of the universe, evolution, towards, and even more so, scientific fallibility of Chazal, the sages of the Talmud, that I quoted and relied upon the opinion of many great rabbinic authorities, from Rambam through to Rav Hirsch, that despite Chazal's great wisdom in Torah, when they made statements about the natural world, it was just based on what people knew back then. And it just sometimes could be wrong. So that opinion was regarded as very controversial, and that's why my books were banned. And in the years following that, right, so there were always people, you know, looking to pounce on me if they felt I'd stepped out of line. And one incident, such an incident and controversy happened with the elephant. So what happened? What happened was that I got email in the email from two teenagers, two students at a yeshiva high school in the US. And they said that they were learning the Gemara, and the Gemara speaks about how do you buy an elephant, right? And not in terms of, you know, which animal dealer do you go to, but rather in terms of halachically, how does the kinyan work, right? Kinyan, when you buy something in Jewish law, it's not just a matter of paying money. It also has to be an act of acquisition, right? In order to complete the purchase, an act of acquisition. So normally there can be different types of acts of acquisition. Normally you can pick something up, right? If you pick something up, then you acquire it, right? If you bring something into your property, right? Once something, you brought something into your property, that completes the purchase. But the Gemara talks about, you know, how do you purchase different types of animals, right? And of course, it's always an option to just bring the animal back to your property, and that completes the act of acquisition along with the payment. But the presumption is that sometimes you want to become the legal owner already at the market. You don't want to wait until you've brought the animal home to be the full legal owner. You want to become the owner on the spot. So how can you become the owner on the spot? So the Gemara says, you know, if it's an animal that's too big to pick up, right, like a horse, so it's okay. You can just lead the horse along, right? And that's the act of acquisition for a horse. But there's one opinion in the Gemara, the opinion of Rabbi Shimon. He says that leading an animal pulling it along doesn't work. Right? If you want to acquire an animal at the market, then you have to pick it up like with every other animal. So the Gemara says, well, according to Rav Shimon, that you have to pick an animal up. How are you going to buy an elephant? It's much too heavy to pick up. And the Gemara gives a somewhat cryptic answer. It says you buy the elephant with bundles of vines. Chavile Zemora, bundles of vines. Now, what does that mean, bundles of vines? So Rashi says it means that you build a platform, right? You make a platform, you pile up the vines in a platform, and you lead the elephant up to climb onto this platform. And by making it climb onto the platform, you have raised it, right? You've therefore, you know, you're not physically picked it up, but you've raised it from the ground, and that completes the act of acquisition. Tosfos, however, right? Tosfos, a collection of medieval commentary in the Talmud. Tosfos says, doesn't like that explanation, because he believes that, you know, if you're raising the ground, that's not called raising the elephant. You just made the ground higher. Also, Tosfos points out that the idea of using bundles of vines, that'll be a weird thing to talk about in terms of making a platform. But what is interesting about bundles of vines, Tosfos notes, is that that's something that appears elsewhere when it's talking about how Noah and the ark was bringing the right kind of food for each animal. It's mentioned that he brings bundles of vines for the elephants to eat. But Tosfos says, oh, bundles of vines are elephant food. So Tosfos, the particular Tosfos, you know, Tosfos is not a person, right? Tosfos is Tosfos is a whole group of people. And one of them, Rabbeinu Meshulam, says, what's the Gemara talking about? It must mean that it's talking about hand dangling the vines in the air, right? And then the elephant will jump up from the ground to reach the vines. And that's how you've caused the elephant to rise up. And that's how, according to Rav Shimon, you can complete the act of acquisition on the elephant in the market. Right? You make it jump up in the air to catch the vines. And what these teenagers were writing to me about, they wanted to know is, can elephants jump? Is that true? Because they had a hard time visualizing it. So what do we say? Can elephants jump? Can elephants not jump? So I looked into it very, very carefully, and I'll get to the explanation soon, but the bottom line was that I do not think, it does not seem that elephants can jump. And this is what I wrote to them, and I found out that the principal of the high school was very, very upset with me. So let's go through it first to see, was I justified in saying that? He said I was being disrespectful towards Tosfos. How could I say that Tosfos didn't know that elephants jump? So let's go through it. You know, how do you answer a question like that? Do elephants jump? So you might be tempted to Google it, which is what their teacher did. And he found a website all about the elephant jumping championships that take place every year in Kenya, where pygmies poke the elephants with spears in their private parts and to see how high the elephants can jump. So the teacher's like, see, elephants can jump. But of course, you can't believe everything you read on the internet, and that was actually a satirical website. There is no such elephant jumping championship at all. So when we're setting out to answer this question, can elephants jump? Now, how do you figure it out? So first of all, you can look at, you know, observation. Has anyone ever seen elephants jump? So people haven't, right? Does that mean maybe they just went to the right times and the right places? But you realize that no, there is a lot of motivation to get elephants to jump because elephants are used in circuses, right? So obviously in circuses, you want the elephants to be as acrobatic as possible. So they have all these tricks, you know, they get the elephant can balance on its head. Elephants can actually walk on a ball, a huge ball, right? They can balance themselves very nicely. But one thing that circuses cannot do is get elephants to jump. And then what about getting the elephant to reach something, right? In the Gemara, well, according to this explanation, what the Gemara means, it means you're dangling the food and the elephant is jumping up to get it. So what happens if the elephant is trying to reach food? So there are certain parts of Africa where the elephants want the choicest fruits of certain trees that are very, very tall. What does the elephant do? Well, it stands up, right? It stands up on its back legs and then it reaches its trunk as high up as it can. And at that point, you know, it's gaining a tremendous amount of height. It can be, you know, 20 feet off the ground, the end of the trunk. But then to jump with two legs, right, the elephants cannot do that. And then what about when elephants are running? So what's interesting is that elephants can move very, very fast, but they can't run. Running is a specific definition. Running is when at some point in your motion, all the person or both of the person's legs or all the animal's legs leave the ground. And if you look at an elephant running, there is no point at which all its legs leave the ground. One of its legs always is in contact with the ground. And also instinctively, we can feel, you know, you can't imagine an elephant jumping. What's the actual explanation of it, though? You know, why can't elephants jump? But the explanation is very, very interesting. And it comes down to a certain principle, which once you understand it, explains so much about the animal kingdom. And it's actually basically a very simple mathematical principle. Okay, so we're going to have to get a bit mathematical here. Sorry, I just have to run and get a drink because my throat is really dry. One sec. Okay, so principle is as follows. Imagine a cube, right? I'm going to have to go metric here, sorry. It's easier for me to work in metric. All right, you've got a cube that's 2 centimeters by 2 centimeters by 2 centimeters, okay? So now let's imagine that cube, right? It has a volume, right? The volume of that cube is 2 by 2 by 2, right? 2 by 2 is 4, 2 was 8, right? So the volume of that cube is 8 cubic centimeters. The cross-sectional area, right? If you take a slice through the cube, the cross-sectional area is 4, right? 2 by 2, right? Actually, let's start with 1, right? You got a cube 1 centimeter square, right? 1 centimeter square. So the cross-sectional area is 1 square centimeter. And the volume is 1 cubic centimeter. You double it, as I said, 2 by 2 by 2. So the cross-sectional area now goes up to 4, but the volume went up to 8. If you double it again, so now it's 4 by 4 by 4, the cross-sectional area is now 16, but the volume is now 4 by 4 by 4, 64. Right, so as things increase in size, the volume increases at a much greater rate than the cross-sectional area. Okay, now that simple fact of math explains so much about the animal kingdom, because the weight of an animal has to do with its volume, right? Its mass, how much of the animal there is. But the strength of an animal, whether it's the bone strength, right, the compression strength, or whether it's the muscular strength, that has to do with cross-sectional area. And as if you're talking about the strength of a bicep, right, the strength of a bicep is not how long the bicep is, right, it's how peaked the bicep is, right? The strength of a bone is not how long the bone is, it's how thick the bone is, right? So bone strength and muscle strength has to do with cross-sectional area, but weight has to do with volume. And as an animal gets bigger and bigger and bigger, the volume increases at a much greater rate than the cross-sectional area. And that explains everything. So if you take a small animal here, take a small animal right here. All right. A beautiful little marbled newt here. Right, see this beautiful little animal? Now, let's look at how the marbled newt stands. You see that? He's alive. You know, he might be a bit too... There we go. Look at the position of his arms. See the position of his arms? They're like splayed out from the side of his body. Right, a small animal like a salamander or a newt, right, he can walk with his arms splayed out from the side of his body. Now, if you were to try and walk like that, it would be very, very hard. It'd be very hard to hold that posture for any length of time. But this newt, right, he's incredibly strong for his size because he's very small. The smaller an animal, the stronger it is for its size. If you look at a mouse, right, how does a mouse stand? Also, a mouse stands with its arms bent, right, bent underneath its body. And it's very advantageous to stand with your arms bent underneath your body because it means if there's danger, you can suddenly spring up out of reach. And a mouse can move very quickly because its arms are always bent, ready to move. But the bigger an animal gets, right, the weaker it becomes because its mass, its volume is increasing at a greater rate than the cross-sectional area of its bone and muscle. So the bigger an animal is, the more upright its posture has to be. Right? Imagine how hard it would be to stand all the time with your knees bent. It would be very, very difficult. Right? It takes a lot of, you know, all that squatting, right? It takes a lot of muscle strength. So we stand in a basically, you know, in an upright position. Our legs are straight beneath us. Right? And when it comes to an elephant, certainly, right, an elephant's legs are straight. They are like columns. And as we've seen, you know, even with the elephant's efforts to reduce its weight, right, we saw that how its bones are honeycombed, right, it has to reduce its weight as much as possible because of this problem that the bigger an animal gets, the greater its mass increases compared to its cross-sectional area. But the result is that for their size, elephants are the weakest creatures. Right? A mouse is proportionately much, much stronger than an elephant. Right, and that has to do with carrying things, right? A mouse could carry another mouse very easily. Right? An elephant could not carry another elephant. And it has to do with movement, right? A mouse is much more agile. A mouse can jump. An elephant cannot jump. It has to do with dropping, right? A kid drops a hamster, right? The hamster is fine, absolutely fine. An elephant, if an elephant were to fall, right, at many zoos, how do they keep the elephants in the enclosure? So a lot of zoos, they'll just have a ditch. Right, the elephant can't jump into the ditch. If it were to jump into the ditch, all its bones would shatter. Right, so elephants are, in an absolute sense, the strongest animals. In a proportionate sense, they are the weakest animals. And that is why an elephant cannot jump. It just doesn't have the strength to do so. And even if it somehow did get off the ground, landing again would break its bones. So elephants cannot and do not jump. Now, what was the concern of the teacher in the school? The concern is that you're making the Tosafist look bad, right? He didn't know an elephant can jump. Tosafist didn't know that. What are we talking about, Tosafist? The answer is, you know, again, why would he have known that, right? You know, in order to know it now, I have to look at, you know, the latest understandings of animal physiology. These were just not present in medieval Europe. But beyond that, this Tosafist, did this Tosafist, Rabbeinu Meshulam, did he ever see an elephant? So it's actually possible to answer that question because elephants were such a rarity in medieval Europe that any time one was brought in for whatever reason, you know, it made the news. It was something of tremendous significance. Right? And we know exactly how many elephants were brought into Europe in the medieval period. You can count them on the finger of one hand. And none of these elephants, I looked into it, and this Tosafist, he never saw an elephant. At most, he could have seen a picture of an elephant. But if you look even at the pictures of elephants that were available in medieval times, these were also done by people who'd never seen elephants. Right? They were all just going after hearsay after hearsay after hearsay. And you look at these pictures of these elephants they've drawn, and the elephants are not very big, and they have arms and legs like lions. Basically, it looks like a lion with a trunk. So there's absolutely no reason not to think that an elephant couldn't jump. So this was a perfectly, you know, valid thing for him to think, and there's no reason to look down upon the Tosafist for thinking that. Now, what about the concern? I found out that their teacher's concern was with, you know, well, you're going to, you know, undermine their respect for the Tosafist. But how did these students contact me? They contacted me by email, right? Which means that if I wasn't going to answer, they were going to do internet research. And apart from this satirical website about the elephant jumping championship, if you look around on the internet, you see very clearly all these websites saying that elephants cannot jump, right? So they were going to find this out anyway. Much better that they should find it out from me, and I put it into context, and I told them, but you have to realize the Tosafist never saw an elephant. It was perfectly reasonable for him to think they could jump. Much better for them to hear it from me in that context than for them to see it on a website feeling that, you know, some non-Jew has caught out the Tosafist. So that's why I believe that the approach I said, not only was it true, but it was not educationally harmful. It was beneficial and important for them. All right, so that is elephants. And then, of course, you have the story with Elazar HaMaccabee, right, who was with the battle elephants of the Seleucid army, and he stabbed the elephant beneath and was crushed by it fell. And that's actually not far from here, a couple of miles from here. I often think how extraordinary it would be. You know, we have a view out of the entrance hall of the museum for miles around the surrounding area. And I often think, you know, it'd be amazing. You know, imagine 2,000 years ago, you might see a herd of battle elephants marching past to fight the Maccabean army. But there's another member of the elephant family that I want to talk about. And for that, we're going to have to move to another room. Hold on. Nail the camera down. And we're developing another hall, a room of special exhibits, which is our most really special, fragile, rare, expensive stuff, things that we can't have out in general view. So it's just going to be something that our donors and special guests and people who pay an extra fee will be able to come in and see it. Hold on, I just need to go in and get the lights on in this room. Can you give me a minute? The main door switch is locked. I'm going into a side door. It's right here. Hi, Mitchell. So we have a parrot here who's recuperating. He might interrupt our talk. All right. So we've got some very
You're frozen.
It's happened. I lost connection for a minute. I'm back. Can you hear me?
Yes.
We can hear you.
Yes.
I can hear you.
Yeah. Okay, sorry about that. All right, so this, we have a carving, a beautiful illustration of a whale, and it's being hunted by some Inuk, right, Inuit.
Eskimos.
They're hunting a whale. Yeah. Eskimos, right. What's this?
Narwhal? Tooth?
No, wrong shape, wrong texture. Tooth, it's a tusk, but not of an elephant. What tusks would Eskimos have access to?
Walrus.
Great. So this is a walrus tusk, right, engraved with some Inuit artwork. But what I want to show you is something else. Oh my gosh, this is heavy. Right. What is this? It's very heavy.
Fossilized tree trunk.
Not tree trunk. Something else.
A mammoth? Mammoth trunk?
Mammoth tusk. Right. Mammoth tusk. This is a section of fossilized tusk from a woolly mammoth. In case anyone doesn't know what a woolly mammoth is. There we go. Woolly mammoth. Now, how did I come by this? So there's a woman who contacted me that her father passed away, and he was she was going through his things, and he was a U.S. Army chaplain. And his situated in Alaska. And during the course of his service in Alaska, he had acquired that tusk of a woolly mammoth and also a fossilized tooth, right? A fossilized molar tooth of a woolly mammoth. So she thought it would be very appropriate to give it to the museum. Also, she said, especially because his first cousin was one of the rabbis who led the Banamai books. So she thought it was also particularly appropriate. So she presented us with this tusk and tooth from a woolly mammoth. And I acquired something else also here in this glass dome. Camera focusing on it. What is that?
Hair
of a woolly mammoth. Right? Now, because, you know, woolly mammoths, they are, how do we find them? It's not that we find their fossils. It's not like with dinosaurs. We find them preserved in ice. Right? So you can even find them preserved whole. You can find their meat. Right? There's people who've eaten the meat of mammoths. They got very, very sick. I wouldn't recommend it. Right, because even though the meat was preserved for thousands, you know, of years in the ice, but it didn't freeze immediately when the mammoth died. Right, it was rotting meat which then froze. So when they defrost it and eat it, they got very sick. But the point is, it's preserved. Right, so mammoth tusks, mammoth hair, it's not that hard to come by at all. And there's no legal, for the most generally, there's no legal restrictions on it. Unlike elephant ivory, which is absolutely, you know, illegal to purchase to have. But there's no problem with mammoth ivory because mammoths are not endangered. They're not endangered. They're not under risk of extinction. They're already extinct. Right. So mammoth tusks and mammoth ivory is not something that has those kinds of restrictions. Now, but the other interesting thing, when they gave us this is that, you know, as I've mentioned, my books have been controversial in the past. Right. And I do understand it. While I don't think anything I wrote in my books was heretical, I can certainly understand that these kinds of topics, you know, and the approach and the Maimonidean rationalist approach to these topics, I can understand why in the ultra-Orthodox community that they don't want to have this. Right. They don't want to deal with it. These questions, they want to insulate themselves from these questions, from these topics. So in the museum, right, because the museum caters to all audiences, right? We have everyone from, you know, Dati to secular Jews to Haredi, ultra-Orthodox. You know, we have Satmar Hasidim coming from Bnei Brak. Right? We don't want to have anything in a museum that will alienate those audiences, right? So there's no museum exhibit explaining that the Tosfos was wrong and elephants don't jump, right? We don't get into that here. And we don't have any dinosaurs on exhibit. We don't have anything about evolution. So when I was presented with this mammoth tusk and mammoth tooth, my question was, you know, mammoths became extinct, you know, a very, very long time ago, not within the last, mammoths, you know, this mammoth tooth is probably 20,000 years old. So, well, I'm perfectly comfortable with that. And I have my own Rambam, Maimonidean-based explanation of it, right, which is a basically a very short version. And Maimonides says that the account of creation in the Torah is not to be taken literally. But for our visitors, you know, that's a no-no, right? For some of our visitors, we can't get into that topic, right? So how am I going to, how can we accept this, this mammoth fossil? I didn't want to turn it down, not exhibit it, right? It's amazing. So I was looking into it, and when I found out it was something very interesting, the very, very, very last mammoths to become extinct became extinct just 4,000 years ago. They hung on in certain parts of Russia and so on, right, until just about 4,000 years ago, right, when the Jews were going down to Egypt, there were still the last few mammoths in this world. So that's the solution. You know, when we put on exhibit in the sign, it will not talk about this particular mammoth fossil, which is 20 or 30,000 years old. We'll say our mammoths are an extinct type of huge hairy elephant, and the last of them died out 4,000 years ago. Fabulous, right? Who's going to have a problem with that? It died out in biblical times. So I hope that's given you a nice insight into elephants and the various different ways in which elephants crop up in Jewish history, in Jewish law. And next week is Shavuot, right? But in 2 weeks, we can meet again. By the way, if any of you are in New York, I'm actually going to New York for Shavuot. And then the Sunday after Shavuot, I'm going to be giving a talk in Queens, in Young Israel, Jamaica Estates, 10 a.m. on Sunday morning. So you can come. I'll be speaking about kashrut controversies. Hey, as always, if you want to find out more, you can come to the museum, Biblical Museum of Natural History, if you want to find out more about elephants in particular. So I have a whole chapter on elephants in my book, The Torah Encyclopedia of the Animal Kingdom. Please do not buy it from Amazon. Instead, buy it from the museum website, biblicalnaturalhistory.org, free shipping in the US. So that's where to get it. Any questions before we wrap up?
Rabbi, you didn't do the external literature with the Maccabees where the elephants come up, the war machine there.
Yeah, yeah, I just mentioned it briefly, but I didn't go into it in detail. Yeah, they were used as, they were battle elephants, correct.
Could you put the name of your book into the chat, please?
Yes. Name of the book is... Yeah, the Torah Encyclopedia of the Animal Kingdom. And you can buy it online at www.biblicalnaturalhistory.org. Okay, any other questions?
Rabbi, could I ask you a question, please, on something unrelated to this?
Yeah.
We're coming up in the Torah about the building of the Mishkan, and it mentions seal skins. Where would they have gotten seal skins in that part of the world?
Well, why do you assume the translation is correct?
It probably isn't. And
Translation is not correct. It's definitely not seal skins. There's been all kinds of views on what it is. We have the various candidates on exhibit in the museum, but they're in all the way back in the other room. So I'm not going to go over there right now. There's all different candidates. There is the dugong. There is the ermine. Some say it's a unicorn. It may actually not be an animal at all. Can't get into it now, but I have a chapter on it in another book. I have a book called Sacred Monsters. Sacred Monsters, also available on the museum website. And that book goes through all kinds of mythical creatures that are mentioned which seem to be mentioned in Jewish literature, like unicorns, dragons, phoenixes, mermaids, all that kind of things. And the Tachash, right, this creature used for the Mishkan, which some people identify as a unicorn, that's analyzed in one chapter of that book.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Right, so... leave it there. I wish you a happy Shavuot, and I'll see you in 2 weeks.
There's a question in the chat from somebody about...
The mammoth descent from elephants or from a common ancestor? I would imagine that they both came from a common ancestor. Right, cousins rather than grandparents and grandchildren.
Rabbi? We know that the Gemara mentions certain medical kind of healing that we know are today are incorrect. So, you know, for stomach and this. Yeah. Why do people have a problem? We know that that's incorrect, and that's Talmudic, and the Tosafot are even later. So why do they really have a problem with contradicting or correcting the Tosafot when we know we have to correct the Talmud?
Because they wouldn't accept the Talmud is mistaken there. They'd say those medicines really work. We just don't know how to use them.
Okay, they're ostriches. What can I say?
Hey, ostriches don't stick their head in the sand, but it's a myth. But I get the symbolism, yeah. Look, they want to have this approach where they learn texts reverentially, not critically or contextually, right? They want this idea that everything you learn in a Jewish text is everything is sacred. And you don't question it. That's the approach they want to develop. I understand the reasons why they want to do it. I just feel that, and maybe it works for them, but for those of us dealing with the modern world, it doesn't work. All right. Thank you. Have a great day. Bye-bye.